Twofootedtackle.com.
Yes, going higher into the world of football than a Zlatan Ibrahimovic foul or an England long ball. It's the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Coming up, Liverpool's fury with England after Gerrard rediscovers the invisible suit he's packed away at the end of last season. Yes, the Three Lions limp to defeat by France. Also, Chelsea's air of invulnerability is going Gyan after Sunderland romped a victory at Stamford Bridge. We'll also be covering the excitement. It is the MLS Conference Final, Ligue 1, Sheffield Wednesday, and much more here on the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Yes, hello and welcome to the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. I'm Gary Andrews. I'm joined by three men who were a lot luckier than me last night. I don't think actually all of them were, but they didn't have to watch the England game in the flesh necessarily. Starting with Two-Footed Tackle's editor, Chris Nee.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. Hello. Are you okay?
I'm very well, thank you. How's it going?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Delightful.
Three men, no sporrans, unfortunately.
Well, bless you for mentioning that.
Indeed, and all the better for it. Also joining us, francophile and West Ham fan, it's the Sound of Football and Football Fairgrounds, Chris Oakley. Bonjour Chris, ça va?
Oui, très bien, merci, et toi?
Formidable.
Bien.
Bien. And finally, the dulcet tones of the cynical challenge's James Appel.
Hi Gary, I was as unlucky as you because I was at Wembley last night, so small correction to your intro there.
Yes, I realised that. I wrote the intro and then you told me just as we were coming into the studio that you were there.
Just keeping you on your toes, Gary.
Well, I know, too much preparation and, this perils of live podcasting or as live podcasting. And seeing as you were there, James, let's go straight into England's performance at Wembley. How much can we read into that game, that defeat to France?
I suppose the answer is everything and nothing.
Very philosophical, very French, if you will, on that. I can imagine Sartre with a cigarette.
Tout et rien, as Sartre probably would have said. Basically, obviously, you have to predicate every single thing you say about England versus France last night with the phrase, it was only a friendly. And yes, it was only a friendly. And it was an experimental side by England. Having said that, I think that as a single 90 minutes of football, it was a very, very apt demonstration of where England find themselves in world football, not just, at international level, but in terms of, the technical abilities, the technical kind of side of things as far as the way we coach young players. I mean, I may be extrapolating too far from this, but you had two sides on the Wembley pitch on Wednesday night, one of whom passed the ball around, played possession football, was patient, effectively played like the home team. And the other side, who as soon as they got the ball, sought to pump it up to a big man a la Wimbledon mid-90s. It was just the perfect demonstration of what's gone wrong with England in the last 20 years.
Well, you mentioned that one side was playing almost like an away side. Chris, were you surprised how deep the French were able to push England? Because Carroll had practically no support up front on his own for much of the first half and a lot of the second as well.
Yeah, well, France are pretty good these days at the sort of moving forward up the pitch due to players having players like Nasri in the middle of the field and Gourcuff, players that just like to drive forward with the ball. And I was a bit surprised, I must admit, that there wasn't quite as much resistance to those attacks as there was. Obviously the England team selection was such that probably a lot of players were looking across and seeing people that they hadn't seen before in the same lineup. There's just a lack of familiarity, so they're bound to be kind of weaknesses in the England lineup. But there wasn't really any excuse for just sort of sitting back quite so much. France are a team very much sort of regenerating at the moment and finding their footing once again.
They have their joie de vivre back.
If you like. Trippier. So in some ways you could sort of have excused England for thinking, well, France aren't what they used to be, and so maybe we can sit further up the field and hold the midfield a bit more. It was a bit unfathomable as far as I was concerned.
Chris N, I mean, we had the debutants in there. Carroll possibly acquitted himself well because that's his strength, having balls pumped up at him. How do you think the rest did? I felt quite sorry for Jordan Henderson having to be stuck alongside Gareth Barry.
Yeah, he wasn't able to play his own game anyway, was he? But with Barry in such poor form, apparently, last night. it's really not going to help. Barry's really disappointed me lately, actually, particularly for England. Gerrard was very quiet as well. So the midfield in general in the first half wasn't really working. When you've got a young debutant in there who's pretty inexperienced, even for his club still, slightly out of position, then he's not going to be able to do himself justice.
Is Capello approaching the Martin O'Neill school of management of square pegs, round holes, put a centre-back at full-back?
Oh, I hope not. I really hope not. It's quite worrying. I'm quickly turning against Capello. I know it was only a friendly, but it was such a demonstration of where we are at the moment, and I think it's pretty clear that maybe he's bringing in the wrong people to play their first games. He's given out what can only be described as kind of sympathy caps for some of the a couple of the strikers that have played recently, not Carroll, but a couple of the others. And I'm not convinced that much is going to happen going forward. So looking forward to the day when we can start afresh with Burton in place and see how it goes.
James, you look at the formation from last night when it was sent out on the field and you thought, good, 4-2-3-1. It's something that I think a lot of people have wanted England to do before. And you thought, well, it's not necessarily a problem having one of those players being sort of a bit more creative in the two. Schweinsteiger can do that for the Germans. And then you looked at the way they played. Could a different coach have got that same amount of same players playing in a very different way, playing in a more French way that the French did last night?
Have you been reading what I've been writing today?
I have. No,
literally cribbed an entire point from something I wrote on ITV's website.
Great minds think alike.
Clearly, I think that 4-2-3-1, very progressive, modern, fresh. We've all been calling for it, and in a way, you can sort of say yes, Gareth Barry. He's kind of got to be in there. And obviously selecting Jordan Henderson, well, that's clearly in hindsight is a wonderful thing. But at the time, I don't think many people were complaining about his selection. I suppose with different players in there, it could work. My main concern actually wasn't the two that played at the base of the midfield. I think that maybe on another day against a different team, perhaps substituting Henderson for someone like maybe an on-form Michael Carrick, maybe that could work. My concern was the two wide players. I think that every time the ball went out wide to either in the first half it was Walcott and Milner, they were isolated. It's probably 20 yards between them and the next England player, and they were double marked by the French. The French worked really, really hard to make sure that the areas on the wide areas of the pitch were covered, and essentially, if you look at where the ball was lost for England in that first half, it was always down by the touchline near the halfway line. So that's partly a problem with the system. That's partly the problem that, if you are going to play that 4-2-3-1, I don't think England are actually capable of doing it at the moment. I think that's really what it comes down to.
Very depressing thought. Had a question from Geeta Archurchi, and this is possibly more interesting than the game itself. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on England fans booing the team last night. Now, I was there, so I was sat around, and I was genuinely quite shocked at the level of vitriol coming from England fans, not just at half-time, but throughout the entire 90 minutes. I was sat around a bunch of England fans who, whenever anybody got the ball, it wasn't, come on, Andy, come on, Stevie G. It was, you better get it in there, you fucking wanker, etc., etc., etc. And that was that. 90 minutes, half time, it didn't even feel like the booing was kind of a response to what was going on there. It felt to me as if the booing was just something that they were expecting to do. Chris, what did you make of the boos and the abuse that the England team got?
I think it was pretty unjustified, really. I think there's this underlying kind of seething sentiment that essentially people are, like Chris, getting, and indeed myself, starting to get a little bit irritated, really, by Capello's antics. So I think that's the kind of underlying level of it. But the fact of the matter is there are a lot of players, I say, out there that haven't played either very much England football before or perhaps even played any England football before. Directly after the World Cup, there was this slight kind of bounce back as England started to sort of find their feet again and get on with the qualifiers for the Euro 2012. And one would imagine that people were starting to sort of think, OK, right, let's start again. We're moving forward again. It was all a bit strange, but I do sort of pick up on this feeling that people are now just thinking, actually, wouldn't be such a bad idea to get rid of Capello now. I personally feel that some of the players he's picking, if you're coming up to a World Cup or indeed a European Championship, you pick players you think, okay, if they're a player that hasn't played much international football before, bid them in early in advance of a competition. Here, if the situation we're in now, the players he's picking, he's either got to now start standing by them and picking them over and over again, or he's got to have some kind of reason for picking them as a one-off. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, we had Kevin Davies last time around. I don't suppose we'll see him again. It's, as you say, it's sort of tokenistic. I just think he's kind of losing the plot. I think he's Jordan Henderson, great player and so on and so forth, but probably picked him on the basis of good form over maybe the last few games at most. I'm not sure that he's been playing quite as well as that since the start of the season. So, Carlton Cole, I mean, I know he didn't play, but on the bench, I just think, well, crikey, if he's picking players like that, there must be someone in better form, striker-wise, than that. I just think he's kind of losing the plot and thinking, well, I've only got a year to go on my contract, let's just bed in some young players. I know he's sort of damned if he doesn't about sort of picking young players for the future, but I don't think he's going to pick them regularly. I think he's just doing it out of trying to make a name for himself.
I suppose the question, though, is, Chris... going back to the booing issue, is are people booing Capello? Are they booing the players? Are they booing officials in the FA who make the decisions? What are they doing? What's the message?
First and foremost, I think they're booing Capello, but they're using that as an excuse. They kind of get sort of so into that whole thing. They go, oh, we might as well just boo the performance now. And, this is starting to feel pretty good, this booing business. So, and they just kind of get a bit wrapped up in the whole thing.
I think there's two things for me. I think there is that underlying resentment of all of the above, which you mentioned when you first started talking, Chris, and there's also the modern need for a lot of fans for instant gratification. I think at international level, particularly with England, that is really amplified. Absolutely. And I think that it's just as soon as something goes wrong, and I mean as soon as in the first few minutes, that's it. And I think England fans do go to those games, and I don't particularly like going to Wembley because people do go to those games expecting to have a good boo and have a good moan, and on top of that, they're not looking at players that they support week in, week out. If Ashley Cole makes a mistake, half the country hates him already. So it's not going to help the situation at all.
I'd say England fans get the team they deserve.
There's just one other thing that I would say on this is I personally don't necessarily object to booing per se. Better than everyone staying quiet, at least. There's nothing like going to a place and at least hearing some noise. What I would just say is that it has to be counterbalanced by some cheering. When things go well, it's quite nice just to hear a bit of a cheer, a chant, and unfortunately at Wembley, having seen it for myself for the first time last night, a home England game, I have to say that the levels of expectation are so high that when things are going well, everyone sits with their arms crossed, and it's only when things are going badly that anyone actually decides to pipe up, that's what really gets my goat.
Moving on very quickly, a few other international games. Chris, I know you very briefly wanted to say something about South Africa USA, which I don't think is getting covered many other places.
It might do. A relatively sort of big story, probably a bit of a flash in the pan, but you never know. Juan Agudelo made his debut, 17-year-old product of the Red Bulls Academy, and he scored a cracking goal to give him a 1-0 win down in South Africa. So it was an inexperienced squad that went, and an even more inexperienced team that started. And he obviously had a great dream debut, and Tim Ream, his teammate, had a good debut as well. So pretty decent evening all round for the States, although Bob Bradley's still not getting that much credit for it. He's not the most popular bloke over there.
The life of an international coach. A couple of other notable results which we haven't quite got time to get into, sadly. Argentina 1, Brazil 0. Fascinating stuff down there. And also Portugal 4, Spain 0. Ronaldo's wonderful disallowed goal, which was a wonderful goal, and disallowed through a variety of reasons. Look it up on YouTube. Go to twofootedtackle, twitter.com/twofootedtackle, because Chris has posted a link up there.
Yeah, wait for all the bitching and vitriol and you'll find it eventually.
Yeah, exactly. And the tantrum afterwards is just as fun. Let's get back to the calmer waters of the Premier League. Chris Nee, just how happy do you think Sunderland fans are now after defeating Chelsea 3-0 at Stamford Bridge?
Well, I would hope they'd be ecstatic because it was a fantastic performance against a team that almost never loses a home game, and they absolutely played them off the park. I think Chelsea probably had the better of the first sort of 20 minutes, but that's about it. And Sunderland, as soon as they got their first goal, I mean, they had two or three shots that came really close just before it, but once they scored, that was the only result that was going to happen. They went on and they got the second goal and then killed it with the third. Fantastic goals, excellent performance. Chelsea played too many centre-backs and full-backs in the wrong place and all sorts. They had three right-backs, didn't they, in the end? Was it three right-backs
three
or
right
four
backs.
Centers?
Three right-backs, yes. So Ivanovic, Ferreira and Bissouma. Yeah, a very interesting team. You looked at the bench, not much depth there. Chris, is this a genuine Chelsea in crisis? Because at the moment, with the Premier League, obviously it only takes one or two games for a team to be described as that. I would disagree with that quite significantly. Or is this the Chelsea's bandwagon slowing down with a view to the wheels coming off? Or is this just a blip from the champions who, admittedly, when you look at their first team squad that should be out there, still very formidable?
I'm inclined to think it's just a blip. I mean, recent history shows, particularly last season, that they had similar brief crises and bounced back from them. You have to, of course, bear in mind that Chelsea have played a fair few games this season. I wouldn't put the defeat down to tiredness exclusively, but that could very well be a minor factor. And I think they just tactically they misjudged Sunderland. Sunderland, I think, bounced back really, really well from the previous hammering that they got. And Steve Bruce just got it right. He set his team up exactly as he should. And Asamoah Gyan mentioned, scoring some great goals. So I think it was just a blip. We could go on, I'm sure, going on about the Ray Wilkins factor and whether that's unsettled the team and everything else. I think it was just one of those just bad days at the office, frankly, and I expect them to bounce back Chelsea from that in the next few games.
Of course, now hot on their heels, Arsenal, after what has to be said was a rather routine 2-1 victory over Everton. James, we've got a question here which I'm going to throw to you from Footy Gold on Twitter has asked, if Arsenal go top of the Premier League, can they stay there?
I mean, that's probably less dependent on Arsenal than it is on their title rivals at the moment. I don't see any of the teams really putting together long runs of good form. Arsenal, probably pound for pound, are the team that are actually playing most consistently, albeit some very strange results at home. Having said that, let's say Chelsea are without Alex and John Terry for the next 6 weeks or so, and let's say Manchester United continue in their rut, and let's say Man City end up sacking Roberto Mancini in January. Well, who knows? I mean, that's looking pretty good for Arsenal, who are probably the most stable of those teams, actually, when you look at it like that. So, reasons to be optimistic for Arsenal fans, perhaps.
Well, you mentioned Manchester United there. Now, Chris, are you crying or jumping for joy or somewhere in between with Villa's result at Manchester United? Because I saw that game. I thought Villa were largely excellent up until the last 10-15 minutes.
I'm jumping for joy, Gary. It was superb. I really thoroughly enjoyed being there, and I was one of the few people, I would imagine, in the stadium who looked at the team sheet unexpectedly and thought, I'm actually now more interested in this game than I was. Fully expected us still to get hammered, but there's something now when your team's not going to get into the top four, as if that's some kind of target, and it's probably not going to get relegated. You need something to keep you excited, and for some of the kids out of the academy to go and put in a performance like that against what was still a very good team despite their injuries, and it was emphatic for most of the second half and a little bit of the first as well. I thought we were excellent.
And Manchester United coming back there, do you think that was just naivety on the part of the young kids from Villa? It was a very young side, and also I was looking through, with the exception of Friedel, it was a side entirely made up of players from the British Isles as well.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Good spot there.
Yes. I'm quite pleased with that. Prefer fewer injuries, and we should have a Spanish centre half playing, but never mind. It was naivety. but it's a naivety that we've had as a club and it, against Manchester United for a number of years. It was entirely on the cards at 2-0. I still celebrated the second goal like an absolute maniac, knowing that we would probably throw it away. But having all those kids in there, it sort of means that, that it doesn't matter. This result isn't going to make or break our season. And throwing it away isn't the same as throwing it away against Stoke like we have done in the past, or against Spurs like we have done. So, I mean, for me, it was just an entirely positive afternoon. I haven't got a bad word to say about it.
Okay, where else do we go? We've got so much to get through still. Obviously, as Chris is in, quick mention of West Ham. I'm not sure whether you want to or not, but yeah, is this a good or a bad thing? Where are they at the moment? Because you keep seeing sort of signs of possible life and revival. And you take the, we were saying last week, you take the results in isolation, they're not bad, but yet they're West Ham, are at the bottom of the table, and if Scott Parker goes under a bus or has some kind of injury,
please just don't even go there.
And
if Scott Parker goes under a bus, I follow him, because that's the end of West Ham's chances, frankly. I mean, every single week you look in the newspaper reviews of West Ham games, you know, West Ham's player of the match, Scott Parker, week in, week out. It's just, it beggars belief. If he goes, then we're in big trouble. I think the situation at the moment is that when we are scoring goals, we can't hang on to the lead. When we then decide to emphasise on defence, we then don't score any goals, as was witnessed in the 0-0 against Blackpool at the weekend. I mean, that match, I think, I can't remember what the exact statistic was, it was something like 38 shots throughout the whole game. Everyone was talking about what an amazing game it was, lots of action. Unfortunately, only four of those were on target for West Ham, and that kind of reflects quite the sort of, you know, how bad they are. The defence is shocking at the moment, West Ham, and I just hope there's a little bit of money in the coffers in January that we can buy one or two decent players just to bolster things, because we are in dire straits. I've been pretty positive up till now about a chance, because we have at times played some good football. But this weekend, I started for the first time to entertain the possibility of relegation, I'm sorry to say. I think I've got to prepare for that now.
Yes.
Razor blades at the ready.
Go back to your homes and prepare for doom.
You might be right in January, because I have just bought loads of dildos and porn.
Excellent. Good man. Want those share prices going up. There we are.
Briefly, a couple of...
I'll speak to you about that later on, Bob.
Moving on. This is a family podcast.
You were the one swearing earlier on.
That was in context.
That was 2 Footed Tackle's first ever F-bomb, I'll have you know.
But it was in context. I felt it was an important thing. It's kind of like if you're quoting somebody saying, see you next Tuesday, in the context of something very important. Anyway,
I was playing in character nonsense. I won't buy that for a moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was quoting from the gentleman who's sitting behind me. Anyway, very quickly, a couple of other ones to briefly mention. James, Liverpool, Stoke. Liverpool turning a corner, then promptly reversing it again. They're just not clicking away from home, are they? I mean, you'd have thought they'd been set up a bit better against a Stoke side. You know what's going to come from a Stoke side when you go to the Britannia.
Yeah, well, Liverpool were rubbish, weren't they? I mean, Liverpool played like the classic mid-table side against Stoke. They just couldn't handle, you know, the play that we all expect. I have to say, must cite Kenwyn Jones. Played a few years at Sunderland and people were calling him lazy. I think Tony Pulis has got him playing, you know, to the top of his game pretty much every week, and he's been a real, real big difference for Stoke up front this season. Excellent player.
I like him. I would have had him at the top of my shopping list for Villa over the summer. I was quite gutted that we didn't go for him.
You'll be able to get a Kenwyn Jones shaped dildo if you ask David Coventry.
It's almost the same thing, right?
I was going to ask you a question about Bolton, Chris. I'm not sure if you're in any state to answer it at this point.
Yeah.
You look at the table, they're fifth place. You've got to say, they're up there definitely on merit, aren't they? A very, very good win over Wolves at the weekend.
Yeah, fantastic game it was as well. I've really enjoyed watching Bolton this season. I think they've taken on my fixation on Stoke last season, who I kind of had a sneaking respect for. But yeah, I think they're in fantastic form. Obviously, Elmander and Davis are doing a real job for them. And they're getting the results, and that was, you know, they almost threw it away against Wolves, but it was a very good performance. Cracking goal from Elmander. Really pleased to see Stuart Holden on the score sheet as well, obviously. And the own goal really got it going after, what, 45, 46 seconds? another great performance from Bolton, another good win, and they are entirely up there on merit.
I thought we should give them the credit they deserve, because we don't often mention this, and normally when you see Bolton on a fixture list, you just go, Bolton. Anyway, loads to talk about next week. There's some great fixtures, Arsenal-Spurs, which we'll mention next week, because, you know, it's not happened yet. Anything we say now might be just completely superfluous, as opposed to the rest
back
of
in five this week, back Arsenal in five. Spurs.
www.2fordidtackle.com for a back in five on Spurs. And we'll be back in just a couple of seconds with Ligue 1 and the MLS. Welcome back to part two of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast with Gary Andrews, Chris Nee, Chris Oakley and James Appel. Let's head over the channel to France. Chris O, as our resident French expert on here, can you get through a chat about Ligue 1 without mentioning the men of Saint-Étienne looking up at Brest? Sarah Cracknell.
Sarah, I should have. There is a crushing inevitability that in the next couple of minutes I will either make a deliberate or involuntary joke about Brest. You know, because it's just when they're being mentioned in practically every sentence, it's going to happen. So,
well,
sorry.
At the moment they are top of the table. Will they be heading downwards? Is there the mid-season sag?
They're not the flops everyone think they're going to be.
This is just turning into the podcast of smart.
Carry on, Two-Footed Tackle. That's what we should call this.
Matron.
Matron. Right, enough. Sorry, yes, back to the script.
Brest.
Stade Brestois, if you will. They've started off tremendously well. They've just completely come out of the blue, promoted last season. And it's been acknowledged by many French football experts who know much more about the game than I do that... what you see nowadays in Ligue 1 is the smaller teams at the top of the table, which I think is great, but they think is a sign of how weak Ligue 1 is. I mean, last season we had Montpellier. This season we've already had Saint-Étienne, who we have to say is a bit of a shock, them being at the top end of the table rather than bottom. Caen, and now Brest. And the reason Brest are at the top of the table is undoubtedly because of their defensive prowess. I mean, they first couple of games they went really in for sort of attacking football, vibrant attacking football, but they were kind of getting a little bit torn apart as they did that. So the manager, Alex Dupont, basically sort of said, okay, right, fine, it's all very good if we play good football but we lose, so let's concentrate on defence. And like, in how many games they played, was it 13 now, I think they've lost three out of 13. They had an 8-game run where they didn't concede any goals at all. I mean, to say that their defence is tight is an understatement, frankly. I mean, their goalkeeper, Steve Alana, he was the he was the Ligue 1 Player of the Month last season, which is kind of a sign of, you know, how organised they are at the back. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic, really kind of stingy. Unfortunately, their attack isn't anywhere near as good, but they are able to defend well and grab the odd kind of single goal victory here and there and draws, and they're there on merit, really. But, you know, you do obviously wonder how long it will last. I suspect it won't last for much longer, but at the moment they're a revelation.
I was speaking to Andy Brassel.
The way you do.
As you do. I was chatting to Andy Brassel. I did ask him about Brest and said, you know, what's the chance of staying up at the top? And he said, oh, I still think Marseille are going to win the title. Would you go along with Andy?
Yep, absolutely. And I'm not just saying that because it's Andy Brassel. They started off poorly, as indeed all the big teams did really this season, but they've hauled themselves up very quickly. They're up to sixth now. And on my Jeu du Jour podcast on Football Fairground, about 5 weeks ago, I said I expect Marseille to be top within 6 weeks. I think they're going to just let me down, but they are making very steady progress. They're looking like they're back to their old selves. And I think it will probably be another couple of weeks, but they will get there. And yeah, I absolutely think Marseille are going to win the title. I said so before the season started. So there we go.
I mean, you look at Ligue 1 and the table on there. You have Brest up the top here with 22 points, and then 12th, Toulouse, 18 points. That's so tight.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it is incredibly close at the moment. You've got, I'm just trying to see here, between top 22 points, Brest, team third from bottom, Lens, are on 14, so 8 points, 3 wins, you could say, separate the bottom three from the top place in the table. It's incredibly tight. It will all split up, I think, and you'll start to see teams sort of grouping up and pulling away at the top now that the likes of Lyon, Bordeaux and Marseille are doing well. Paris Saint-Germain, we've mentioned before, they're finally hitting good form, they're doing very well, and Montpellier are on a good run as well, so it won't probably be that close for very much longer, I suspect, but interesting.
Chris, you mentioned Paris Saint-Germain.
Yes.
There have been some rumours, I hasten to actually identify these rumours, about Arsene Wenger recently.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the rumour has been Wenger has certain aspirations to come back to France, perhaps manage Paris Saint-Germain, you know, the one team, you know, that, you know, it's a single team in one of the, Europe's biggest capitals, mm-hmm. has perennially underperformed. Are there any truth in these rumours? Is there ambitions on the part of Paris Saint-Germain to really go all out and try and establish or maybe re-establish themselves as a kind of major force?
I think there's always those ambitions. Personally, I think that will be Arsene Wenger's swan song. I think he'll leave that to the end of his managerial career when he's kind of thinking, oh, you know, I want to do this for maybe another year or two. And I think he'll leave that till the end if he gets the opportunity. Obviously, you can't necessarily plan it, but I think I don't think he'll go there yet. But I think I think there's every chance he will go there at some point, but not until the end of his managerial career. And you know, Paris Saint-Germain, I think, have sort of turned a bit of a corner now after a couple of years of doing poorly. They're doing very well in the Europa League at the moment, and they're up to fourth. I think there's every chance they'll get into Europe next season, so I don't think they're that desperate for him just yet.
Mm. What about the other big teams, the underperformers, if you will, although still not that far off the top? Your Bordeaux and your Lyon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I mentioned before, they started off very, very poorly. Bordeaux, in particular, had a lot of injuries. Had a lot of injuries at the start of the season. But they've pulled it together. Lyon finally have managed to get themselves up into the top half of the table, only this weekend just passed. Lyon are now starting to get some real sort of cohesion between their new signings that they made at the start of the season. So they're heading now in the right direction. And I would say give it about a month or so and you'll start seeing all those big teams. Even Auxerre. Auxerre had a horrific start to the season. We're in the bottom three only up until maybe about sort of 3 weeks ago, and they're now sort of heading up and have got themselves in the top half of the table. Still not doing too well in their Champions League group, but then they're in a particularly tough Champions League group, as we know, with Real Madrid and Milan. But yeah, it's surprising really that they took a while to get going, but they're off and running now.
And what about Lyon's big summer signing? How is he fitting in?
Gourcuff, yeah, he started well. He's put in a lot of good performances for the national side as well as for Lyon. Last couple of games, not quite so good. But yeah, he's starting to repay that, whatever it was, €21 million transfer fee now. And, you know, along with Gignac and so on, they're doing really well. Gourcuff, I think he's now showing why there was so much persistence on the part of Lyon to sign him up from Bordeaux. I mean, they tried several times before but couldn't wrestle him from the club, but he's paying them back in spades now.
Mm. James, I know you, just to go back briefly to the England-France game, I know you were hugely impressed by Gourcuff in the French side.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I could have waxed lyrical about quite a few members of that France side last night. I think, you know, Malouda, for example, just to stray off topic a little bit, I always thought of him as a winger, but the way he came inside, the way he was, pulling all the strings in that midfield. But Gourcuff was the one, really, you know. He always seemed to have that extra yard, extra second of thinking time. He really, really caused England a lot of problems, because you'd expect, in the position that he plays in, to be picked up by either of the two central midfielders, the holding players. But he just buzzed in and around that space in between defence and midfield that no one ever really got the handle on him. And he was just superb all night. And I mean, do you think that perhaps the transfer to Lyon has a kind of kick-started this, or was he always playing like this domestically and it's just only now really it's come to fruition at international level? Or
no, I think he was always a good player at Bordeaux, but I think he was just going a little bit stale really towards the end. I think he sort of needed the challenge, and perhaps secretly he was actually hoping to get a move to a bigger club, or at least a club with a bit more ambition. Although I think in his last year or two, Bordeaux did win the league and title, but I think, as I say, he'd been there a few years and started going a bit stale, so it was probably a good move for him. But he's always been an eye-catching player, really, all the time he was at Bordeaux.
And briefly looking at the very bottom of Ligue 1, any hope at all for Arles the club that has provided much entertainment off the field for Ligue 1.
Yeah, Avignon, they've only won one out of their 13 games, and they are one of the other promoted teams that we mentioned, along with Brest. And they've really struggled. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned before that they had this horrific summer, you know, the close season. They had their director, I think their director left the club, then the manager was sacked, then the manager was reinstated a short while afterwards, and when the manager was reinstated, he found that they only had like about 12 players left at the club because of, you know, lack of finances and whatever, so he had to kind of go around just snapping up as many players as they could. Absolute chaos, and eventually he was sacked on a permanent basis about sort of 5 weeks into the season, and it's not looking good for them. Unfortunately, Arles are very, very rarely in the top flight, and they've hauled themselves up in a short space of time to the league, but they're heading straight back from where they came, I'm sorry to say, in my view.
Okay. Chris, thank you. Let's stay overseas. Let's move on to another foreign league, the one that's coming to the end of its season. MLS, Chris N. We now know who the finalists are for the MLS Cup. Were they the ones you were expecting?
Not entirely. I was expecting the Galaxy to do it from last week, and then if you go back all the way to the start of the season, there's just no way I would have put these two. It's the Rapids against Dallas, take place in Toronto in the early hours English time of next Monday morning, and it should be a really good game because they aren't necessarily the most fancy teams in the league, but they are two of the teams in the best form as the season closed. And you know, Dallas are a very attractive team to watch, and Colorado are really progressive and attacking as well at the moment, so could be a good fun game to check out if you can be bothered to stay up until that time.
Are you surprised that Dallas took apart Galaxy? Yeah, 3-0. Did that scoreline flatter the Galaxy, or did it flatter Dallas?
It flattered Dallas, actually, to be honest. It was certainly not a 3-0 sort of difference in my book. Kevin Hartman, for me, was a man of the match. Dallas's goalkeeper, a string of brilliant saves, and really kept them in it for the most part. And they were clinical in front of goal, and that's pretty much all you need to do. If you've got everything right at both ends of the pitch, you're going to win tough games.
And as for Colorado, I think we've said this before, but they've kind of just kept under the radar. They've just been almost the model of consistency this season.
Yeah, they have been very consistent, and it's been largely due to being pretty decent in defence and having Connor Casey and Omar Cummings in storming goal-scoring form in the running. So really quite pleased for their fans, wherever in the world they may be.
One sitting across the other side of the studio from
Justice, at last. All these years of waiting, finally the Rapids do well.
So, big question, Chris. Who is going to take the MLS Cup? In your humble opinion.
Heart says Dallas, head says Colorado. I think they'll just be too solid. Dallas will be, you know, they're on a real high at the moment, and they were coming off of the back of a game where they really weren't fancy to win it, whereas Colorado's final in the East was much more evenly matched, and they won't have considered themselves miracle workers to get through.
Okay, a few other things going on in MLS as the season draws to the close. Kansas City Wizards, no more.
Nope, the Wizards are gone. They are now Sporting Kansas City, which is a real shame because, you know, why go from one stupid name to another stupid name, frankly? So there's a little bit of a bitching session over in the States at the moment. About
why have they? Is it change of franchise or just...
No, it's just one of these kind of... They've got a new stadium coming and they're seeing it as an opportunity to get rid of the American sporting name and go for a European sporting name, which it's just bizarre. Why not just call it Kansas City Football Club? If you want to go European, why not just call it Kansas City?
Indeed. A couple of the expansion teams, rumoured targets, Lee Hendry and Jay DeMeritt, rumoured to be on their way to America. Any truth in those?
Jay DeMeritt signed, announced this afternoon after we wrote the script. So, yeah, he'll be at Vancouver. He's their first MLS signing under their new kind of regime. And, yeah, Lee Hendry claimed to have been approached by Portland Timbers, who quickly denied it in the Oregonian newspaper. So, yeah, he won't be in America anytime soon.
How has Jay DeMeritt been without a club for so long?
Strange, isn't it?
I mean, he left Watford in the summer. I think he's only about 32. I think did he go to the World Cup?
He played most games for the USA, I think.
So he was obviously fit enough to play at the World Cup. And I believe he was on trial at Leeds.
Okay.
I mean, I may have got that wrong, but it was certainly mooted in the summer. I just have no idea how it's taken him until November to find a club after.
No,
after
strange. He may have had an eye on getting back to MLS. It has apparently been in the works for quite a while. And obviously, you know, he got to the World Cup despite taking his time to recover from a pretty horrendous eye injury. So his club football career hasn't really been where he would like it to be. I think he's probably had his eye on the Whitecaps for a while.
If a 54-year-old Robert Pirès can sign for Aston Villa, then there's hope for him, surely.
Absolutely.
And for those of us who are interested in the inner workings of the MLS, slight change to how things are being done next season.
Yeah, the Commissioner Don Garber did his State of the League conference call earlier this week, and it's very much looking forward to 2011, what's going to happen there. He confirmed that it will be a 34-game schedule, which sounds like it's obvious, but you never know. He didn't confirm that it'll be a balanced schedule, so you may have teams that play each other three times and once rather than just twice, which, given the number of games that will be played and the number of teams in the league, they could just play each other twice. So hopefully, my personal view is that they should go for a balanced schedule. The rosters are up to 30, which has in turn facilitated the return of the reserve league, which is obviously a great thing. And to confirm, along with those two things, that they're beginning to look towards the youth, they are ending the restriction on the number of homegrown players. And homegrown players are the ones that come out of the academies. The limit is two at the moment. It used to be one, and they're just scrapping it. So okay, they can bring through as many kids as they want now.
And what's the significance of that, of those changes for MLS?
It's a big shift towards at least considering a focus on bringing through youth players that didn't necessarily come out of college. So encouraging, I would say, for American soccer.
Very encouraging. Okay. Well, we'll leave it there for MLS. Coming up in part three, we're going literally all over the place. That's not just my presentation style. Sheffield avoid a Black Wednesday. Plus, we'll have a look at the FA Cup, a bit of Russia, which will please James, and much, much more. Part three of the Two for the Tackle podcast. One of the more nail-biting fixtures this week took part, as many of them sadly do these days, in the courtroom. Sheffield Wednesday got a stay of execution from the winding-up order issued to them. Joining us on the line is Wednesdayite Chris Ledger. He's from the excellent Obscure Football and Music blog. Chris, you must be a very relieved man.
Obviously, it's a great relief to obviously have this 28-day adjournment. We sort of really feel before the after we came through that we were sort of possibly a suspension of administration. Obviously, the main problem now, although we've got the adjournment, which gives us a lot more time to place investment, the sort of real deadline is, as Nick Parker suggested, is really the 1st of December, when we've got another winding up order for the £300,000 we owe for VAT arrears. So, obviously, that's sort of is a major problem, so sort of we need to buy an investment before the 1st of December, ideally.
How did Wednesday get into this situation? Does it still go back to the days of Gilles de Bild and Wim Jonk that were signed on huge wages when you're in the Premier League?
It certainly does go back to those days. In the sort of mid-90s, the chairman, Sir Dave Richards, allowed Charterhouse to sort of buy a number of shares into the company. Sort of invested about $16 million in the club. So around that time, sort of spent a lot of money on players like Gilles de Bild, Wim Jonk, Peter Carboni, Pablo de Canio. So obviously we sort of spent a lot of money during that time, and we went from being a profitable company to being £60 million in debt in 1999. And gradually, it's sort of gone worse to obviously being around in about $27 million debt now.
Obviously, things are looking pretty bleak now. Where does Sheffield Wednesday go now that they've got this day of execution? Are the investors, because we've heard so much that investors are on the way, it's one of the reasons that the Co-op Bank paid off your last winding up order. Are these investors actually going to materialise, or are we looking at administration for Wednesday?
I think it's sort of a complicated situation in regards to getting investment. We've sort of got several creditors in the club. We've sort of got a Co-op Bank, but also we've got a lot of loan note holders, people like Dave Allen, Keith Addy, Jeff Hulley, Bob Gryson, Ken Cook, Mick Wright, who also wants an investment company. So in order to actually sort of get the investment we need, both the Co-op and the loan note holders need to be satisfied, and so far we've not really had the investment that's materialised that sort of satisfied everyone. obviously the Milan-Mandzukic deal, it sort of failed to satisfy people like Dave Allen and possibly Mick Fash as well. And there's a possibility of the Wednesday forward bid with Spence Fir not really satisfying the co-op. Because basically sort of the deal is really to invest in the sort of players and to gradually repay the co-op with the aim to get into the Premier League. So obviously that's going to be a major problem. And if we can't get that investment, administration is likely to be an issue in the 1st of December, and it could possibly get worse on the 15th of December.
Yeah, obviously that's the date when Wednesday back in court. Of the bids, I mean, would as a fan, would you want Milan Mandzukic running your club? Do you think that's a good person to come in, given that he seems to be one of possibly one of the front runners?
I think it would really be an excellent choice at the minute. I'm happy to sort of accept most people into the club at the minute, obviously with the sort of status of it. Obviously, I think Mandzukic is a bit of an enigma in the whole chairman world. I thought he did an excellent job at Portsmouth. I think a lot of the problems sort of stemmed after Mandzukic left. And the good thing is that he sort of wants to pay the cop a lot of the loan back of the 7 million that they want. He's sort of got plenty of funds, so I think that would be an excellent choice.
If the club did go into administration, you're still, you're mid-table in League One. If they took that hit, could you see Wednesday staying up with the current playing squad that they've got?
I think it could be a possibility that we'll get relegated if we're into administration. At the minute, sort of, like you said, we're safe from mid-table, and if we went into administration, we'd be a second bottom. Last season, when we got relegated, sort of confidence was a big issue. It sort of dipped quite a lot during certain points, and there's a possibility of happening again with the issue of administration if that came in.
In terms of the playing situation, because it is quite sad to be talking about clubs that are in that level of administration. So let's move on to the pitch very briefly. How have you felt about Alan Irvine this season? Do you think he's the right man for the job? Do you think the squad's strong enough if you don't have to take that hit of 10 points from administration? Do you think they could go back up again?
I think if he went to administration, it would be very likely we'd get up again for promotion. The sort of squad we've got is very good. On paper, I think it's the strongest in the division, but I think there's sort of been a lot of problems with Alan Irvine's tactics. There's sort of been a very negative this season. I think the main problem with Irvine is that he's sort of prepared too much for matches. He's sort of worried about the opposition more than our sort of strengths. And that's sort of why we haven't really fulfilled our potential so far. And I think we can sort of stay up if we hit administration, possibly, but I think going up is definitely a weapon.
James, I guess something like this shows that no club is too big to experience these kind of problems at all, because Wednesday, obviously, a very big name, James.
It certainly does tell you that even the biggest clubs can find themselves in financial problems, but I think that it strikes me, and Chris, I'd like to ask you your opinion on this, that Wednesday, the fact that it's been going on for 15 years, indebtedness and just a downward spiral, I find it interesting that Wednesday haven't really produced in that period enough players to be able to sell on and maybe try and alleviate the debt. I think, I may be wrong, but I can only really recall Chris Brunt being a major signing that has gone on from starting at Sheffield Wednesday to actually, making a career at a higher level. Do you think that Wednesday have a major problem producing good players that they could then sell on and maybe, finance themselves for the future?
I think that's sort of definitely a problem. I think through either sort of producing youth players or bagging players, I think that's sort of been a major problem with the club. We've sort of had some good young players coming in, like Mark Beavers, and we've also bought sort of several good players, but we haven't really sort of produced the talent really that we can sort of sell at a profit. And most of the sort of players we bought have really sort of been released, like Francis Jeffers or Etienne Ajayis, or they just sort of haven't really made much of an impact.
In terms of just getting back to Wednesday's off the field situation, in terms of the supporters, are the supporters kind of ready to, I guess, band together? Is there a trust up there? What's the trust like up at Wednesday?
At the minute, there's sort of a scheme for Wednesday Till I Die, which is really sort of a scheme for all the Wednesday fans group sort of collaborated together for the first time to try and sort of save the club, and so the club can become fan-known. Whether it will work or not is another matter, but I think that's sort of one way the sort of fans are getting together by sort of building an emergency fund to try and help save the club.
Is there any been any talk of getting the fans onto the board, or is that something you're just happy to let whoever comes in come in and take control of the club?
Well, at the minute, sort of Wednesdayite, one of the main supporters groups, sort of owns over 10% stake in the company, or in the club itself. But I think the aim for Wednesdayite is for the fans to take over the club, but I think most fans are happy for whoever takes over in order just to save the club.
Okay, finally, how do you rate your chances for this weekend?
Hopefully 3 points. I think we always hope of and expect a victory. But hopefully, sort of after this week, the players will sort of come together and play as a team. So hopefully, despite the off-field problems, it possibly could lead to on-field benefits.
Okay, Chris Ledger from Obscure Football and Music. Sorry, thank you very much.
Twofootedtackle.com.
Thanks very much to Chris Ledger. You can follow him on Twitter at Obscure Football. I would recommend it. His stuff's really excellent. He really does know his stuff. Had a quick comment actually from Jamie Cutteridge, who knew that Chris Ledger was coming on. He said, if there's an argument among guests on tonight's pod, does that make it a crisscross? Personally, I'd argue with the group of guests we've got, it's more of a case of Christmas has come early.
Make of that what you will.
My favourite thing about that is you actually wrote tumbleweed in the script.
I know what to expect in here. Some weeks you get people willing to add into the Chris puns, if you will, but not this week. I was trying to work in Chris Tingle, but I thought that was leading us into areas we really didn't want to go into.
I tried to think of a Chris gag, but I think you've just used them all up.
Yeah.
There's only two, to be fair.
Indeed. Right, OK. moving on. FA Cup. Exciting. Hey, James, last week we talked about all the world's eyes, well, some of the world's eyes, at least, being on AFC Wimbledon versus MK Dons in the second round. But blow me down with a feather. Stevenage have only gone and crashed the party, or the wake, if you're a Wimbledon fan, or would have been a Wimbledon fan for that game.
Yeah, they've shot down the media's aspirations for the big Wimbledon MK Dons unifying fight, or whatever you want to call it. I must admit I haven't seen the highlights of the Stevenage MK Dons game, but given that Stevenage were a non-league team not so long ago, you could say that's probably a giant killing. And I know that they're now in League Two, but there won't be the winners of Ebbsfleet against Wimbledon, which we'll find out once this pod goes to air. Won't be looking forward to playing Stevenage. I'm sure probably they would fancy them a bit more so than they would against MK Dons, but that'll be a tough game.
Do you know they got a 95th minute equaliser, was their equaliser against the MK Dons, and then went through on penalties. One of the few times I think Graham Westley's been a very popular man with Wimbledon fans. But yeah, I mean, to be honest, actually, I'm would have looked forward to any of the combinations on there, because I think you have sort of a big balance. Even if you have Ebbsfleet come through, they're still playing a club that's two leagues higher than them. Wimbledon, one league higher. There's still, with Stevenage, still a potential for the giant killers of Stevenage to now be giant killed themselves.
Well, it is going to be on TV, so I'm sure they'll be spinning any kind of storyline out of it, whatever the outcome. As I said on the pod last week, it's great to go to be able to watch football in places that you just don't see very often, and that accounts as much for Stevenage as it does for AFC Wimbledon, as it does for Ebbsfleet. That's really what the FA Cup's all about.
Indeed. Obviously, Chris, the other big game, if you want big game, but the excitement really, Woking against Brighton, which was, well, you had it all, didn't it? Woking going 2-1 up with just a few minutes left to play. Brighton immediately equalising, penalties. Great drama there down in Woking.
Yeah, they seem to have flaked out on the penalties, Woking, a little bit, don't they? They didn't score one, I don't think.
No, I saw three genuinely terrible penalties. Oh, but hey, you can't knock a team that's like Woking that has taken the League One leaders all that way.
I had a very strange FA Cup night on Tuesday, because I was with Andy Brassel on Tuesday as his team watched on as Stevenage knocked out Milton Keynes, so he was very happy about that. And then on the way home, had to change at Woking, so I was kind of got the train back down towards Portsmouth with lots of Brighton fans and a few Woking fans. And they were saying it'd been a pretty good night, you know, they got a decent crowd there. Probably the right result in the end, and Woking fans were able to leave the stadium with their heads held high. So congratulations to them. Shame they couldn't go through. Mm. I have been to Woking, and it's okay. it's a little bit strange, but it's all right, and it would have been nice to see them knock out Brighton. But Brighton are in great form this season, and it wouldn't be a surprise to see them go on and do reasonably well.
And the winners, Brighton, now face FC United of Manchester, which is another very, very tasty looking second round tie.
Yeah, end of the road for FC United, I think.
You think Brighton are wobbling a little?
They've got to be too good, though, haven't they, for this?
You think they're without their star player, who's only on loan, Kazenga Luwa-Luwa, who was excellent. When they played around, they can move a bit, but they've sort of just lost their momentum a little bit. And I think unless they get a couple of wins or you know, get that back under their belt, FC United will really fancy that one.
Yeah, they've got the tails up FC United cup wise anyway, haven't they? So it's certainly an intriguing clash.
Mm, definitely. Chris, down your neck of the woods, there was Orient versus Dagenham in the replay.
Yes, yeah. Big sort of, well, say local derby, I mean local-ish, but Dagenham and Redbridge actually only about a couple of miles away from where I live. I think they're always chasing that game, from what I can make out. They got a couple of goals back, two goals in 2 minutes, I think it was, but Orient were just too good for them. Dagenham Redbridge's form at the moment, a little bit of time up and down, but a bit of a shame for my very local team, but Leighton Orient haven't had much to shout about this season either, so good luck to them.
Yeah, well, and they're away to Droylston in the next round from Manchester, and I think that will be a very, very tough tie, and I'm very tempted to put some money on Droylston to win that one.
Certainly, yeah, I'd agree with that.
There will, of course, be at least one non-league team guaranteed in the next round. That's either York or Darlington, which seems very odd to say one of those two non-league teams guaranteed in the next round. But York, fantastic result for them, beating Rotherham 3-0. Brilliant stuff.
You look at that and it doesn't feel like an upset, does it? I mean, remember that York are in the conference.
And they are struggling, York. Mm. They're actually in the relegation zone currently from the conference. They're very up and down team, York. They kind of, one season they're up in the playoffs, and the next season they battle against relegation. So, lovely away day up at York, actually. Beautiful city. Beautiful city.
Yeah.
Is it better than Aldershot? I'm
not even going to dignify. Actually, we had I can't remember who it was. Somebody on Twitter said they had a brilliant Hereford experience.
Who is this person? Give them a knighthood. They've enjoyed what no man can enjoy.
I think it might have actually been Damon TH who asked us a question. He was at, I think, Woking against Brighton, and said, is terracing chat too old hat? Was brought in sharp focus for me on Tuesday. My first seat experience for a while. Ugh. Extra ugh on the end of that. I have an opinion on this, as you might expect.
Go for it, Gary.
I love being on the terraces. That's where it feels natural to me. But I've worked out that if I actually want to watch a game and sort of take any notes and actually be able to critique the game afterwards, I need to be sitting and I need to be roughly on the halfway line. So it's purely professional for purposes. If I have nothing, if I'm not going to be writing, if I'm not going to be reporting, then I'm more than happy to be jumping around with the rest of them.
It's surely time for the debate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Standing stuff, definitely. I mean, Chris, when we were over in Germany, not that I keep wanting to hark back to some FOD, but you've seen how it can work over in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, just a fantastic experience, isn't it? I mean, yeah, it just adds to the kind of atmosphere, kind of standing cheek by jowl with your fellow supporter and everything. So, yeah, I'm a bit kind of caught between two stools, or two seats, if you like, on this myself. I mean, one of my kind of fondest memories is my first game that I ever went to see, which was West Ham v Orient, Boxing Day 1980. Big match cameras there. I could see Brian Moore's shining pate up in the commentary box. My cousin took me along. We got there early, and I remember sitting there as a 9-year-old on the steps of the terrace and just watching the place fill up. We got there sort of early, and there is a place for it. I hope that somebody can work something out so that we can start seeing terraces in football again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think Chris Nee's point about it being, you know, time to reopen the debate. I think that time is the key word here. You know, most of us, actually, and I think quite a lot of the people who listen to this pod are part of the post-Hillsborough generation. My first live football match was in 1991. And to my mind, I'm able to look at this issue probably devoid of the trauma of the people who actually witnessed that firsthand or were actually there, you know. And that's probably why my attitude is I don't see any reason why we can't have terracing in the UK. It astounds me. Every other country seems to be able to do it, you know, in particularly Western Europe, where it's, you know, nicely kind of segregated stadiums and sort of well stewarded. It can be done safely.
Well, on the subject of stuff, a comment on the continent and elsewhere. Real FA Cup has asked flares at evening FA Cup replay should be compulsory, not stamped upon by Jobsworth Rozzers. I think this is referring to the Woking game as well. Or are they a menace? What are people's opinions on that one?
No more so than drainpipe trousers, I'd have suggested.
Yeah, I think the point about being in the evening, surely we're talking about tuxedos rather than flares, aren't we?
Yes.
You've got to dress up nicely for an evening game.
Quite so.
I think flares are still fashionable in Woking, aren't they?
They never went out of fashion, did they?
It depends what type of flares, because if you're talking about the Flares nightclub that I used to frequent in Cardiff from time to time when I was a student there, flares in the evening is never a good idea in that point.
I think the good people of Woking might have to go to Guildford to get their flares fixed in that sense.
Really? There's one there as well?
I think it's still open. Oh, hideous place.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, type of place that you go there if you want to pick up a divorcee in the late 40s, I believe.
If anyone should know. Yeah. Sorry.
Should we talk about flares?
Yeah, shall we? Shall we? I mean, to me, the other type of flares. I've watched a lot of Italian football, and to me, I love looking at the terraces with the flares on. I think it adds colour, and I think I don't know whether generally throwing it out to the pod.
Great idea.
Maybe I'm sort of being naive, but I'm with you on this. But just when you see shots of the crowd and there's this kind of colourful flare going off, I mean, as I think we just sort of said sort of off air, as long as they're not thrown at anybody or thrown onto the pitch, then fine. It just adds to the atmosphere. You know?
Yeah, I mean, in all the time that I've been watching football, I can think of only one incident, which was the flare thrown onto Dida during that Champions League game that was of any consequence that involved a flare. So that's my point.
Do they have any much in the way of flares over Eastern Europe, or do they have?
Oh, it's practically the law that you have to bring them in. There comes a point actually during a 0-0 draw in Russia where it gets to about 80 minutes, and the people with the flares in their pockets are like, "Well, we've just brought them, so we might as well just let them off now." So, like, it's in the middle of a 0-0 draw. There's nothing going on. Like, the ball goes out for a throw-in, and suddenly, like, the entire stand sets on fire. Yeah, and it's like, oh, they're just using up the flares that they brought. That's fine. It is a great sight. It is genuinely breathtaking sometimes when you see an entire half of a stadium lit up.
My only recent experience of them was in Prague with Villa, and it was great fun. Give or take one or two that ended up sort of near the pitch, but there was more stuff going on around it that led to that. But as it was, people standing in there with a couple of flares, it was superb. They had Kingstonian fans had one recently as well.
The Kingstonian ultras.
Yeah, scary boys.
And speaking of ultras and flares, it leads us nicely onto Italy. Serie A, the Milan derby, notable for many things. Zlatan Ibrahimovic's kung fu assault on Marco Materazzi being the most memorable thing I can think of.
Yeah, I think Materazzi was having a bloody good go for him, though, wasn't he?
Quite
a shocking challenge that was from Materazzi as well. Both of them, awful.
They've got history, I think, somewhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in that game, there was history. Materazzi managed to bring Ibrahimovic down after about 4 minutes, which led to the penalty that won the game in the end. And they just can't keep their hands off each other.
Hey. I'm sure Zlatan would have something to say to you about that one.
Yeah, he would say, "I don't touch Materazzi, I am Zlatan."
Well, I think he'd probably say, "Send your sister round," which was what he said to when there was the rumours of Pique. It was just like, you think I'm going to send your sister round, I'll show you otherwise. Yes, so Milan derby, though. I mean, Inter losing that one, and Milan sitting at the top on there, 6 points behind Inter are on there. That's pressure on Benitez. I mean, Italy always has pressure on the manager, especially if you're the manager of one of the Milan clubs, but that's more so than usual.
Yep, it just shows the difference between Benitez and Mourinho for me. They just would not have allowed themselves to lose that game with 86 odd minutes left to go under Mourinho. It simply wouldn't have happened. I haven't been that impressed with Inter this season particularly. One or two players are shining. Cambiasso had been brilliant before he was injured and so on. Eto'o's gone off the ball ever so slightly as well. Milan are doing okay, you know. They were slightly lucky to hold on to a win against Napoli. And a better Inter team would have probably beaten them on Sunday. So perhaps slightly fortunate to be dealing with a Benitez Inter rather than a Mourinho Inter when they're having their own high point. And suddenly my post at the start of the season saying that Milan were challengers doesn't look as stupid as it did after a couple of weeks of the season.
And what I'm impressed about, not afraid to bench the stars. No Ronaldinho for Milan.
No, well, they've got so many options up there, haven't they? And Robinho started that game with Ibra. Kevin Prince-Boateng made an appearance as well. And they've got lots of firepower. They seem to be using it relatively wisely. I think maybe Allegri's he's learned how to use these players to the best effect. And they're doing really well. Three wins on the trot in the league, and in great form. So yeah, thoughts on Milan.
Have you heard Balotelli's comments today? That he says he doesn't see himself being at Manchester City much beyond the summer. Rumours of him linking up again with Zlatan at Milan.
Yeah, I'm sure he's desperate to get there. I mean, there is no secret about where Balotelli wants to end up in his career, and it's Milan. So whether it will be that soon, I'm sure Manchester City will have a say. But yeah, he'll end up there sooner or later because they really want him as well.
Mm. And you say you're not impressed with Inter. Can Rafa really can't win, can he? Because he's inherited this all-conquering team. And whatever he does, if he really can't win, whether he's winning, losing or drawing. If he's winning, it's down to Mourinho's players. If he's losing, well, there's obviously one thing that's different, which is the coach.
Yeah, maybe that's what he's up to. Maybe he's just lowering the expectations a bit so that when he starts winning, it's all down to him. I think it's a really difficult task. He's taken on a team that's just won the treble, got some of the absolute very best players in the world, and most of them have won everything there is to win. So it's not as easy as it looks, that job.
I was just going to say, a few of them have been injured as well, haven't they?
They've had a few. Cambiasso is the one for me who's been the big injury. Materazzi came into the centre of defence against Milan and didn't do too well. That was his first start of the season, I think. It's not going so well, but you know they're still in touch. Inter will go on a run at some point this season. It's just down to whether the likes of Milan and Lazio can hold them off.
But will they have Benitez in charge? Or will they have Zenit St. Petersburg's coach in charge? The title winning coach, yeah. Zenit St. Petersburg.
That's a very good question. As you said, Gary, Zenit St. Petersburg wrapped up the Russian title this weekend. They beat Rostov 5-0, which I suppose is probably the best way you can win a league title, isn't it? A home 5-0 win. And immediately after the game, there was a rumour put about in the Italian press that has slowly gained quite a lot of traction that Inter are now eyeing up Zenit's title-winning coach Luciano Spalletti as a replacement for Rafa Benitez. Now, it doesn't usually come to pass that these rumours get discussed an enormous amount in Russia. Very often, a lot of the press and, to a certain extent, people involved themselves are not particularly forthcoming about discussing rumours. But Spalletti's been very open this week, talking about the link with Inter. He said that he's not interested in leaving Zenit. He says, as far as he's concerned, he is going to be at Zenit next season unless his superiors judge otherwise. And he's also said that Inter haven't approached Zenit anyway to discuss it. But there's something in me that says that the lady doth protest too much.
Do you think he'd be a good fit for Inter? I mean, he's obviously got the history with Roma there and everything. But, you know, obviously he's won the title in some very convincing fashion. Over in Russia.
Yes, Zenit have been excellent. And much like Zenit, in a sense, Inter are the kind of team that are prepared to, you know, plough a lot of resources into, you know, creating a title-winning team. You know, creating an empire, not just a one-off, one-season wonder, but actually, you know, creating something with heritage. Which is what the plan has been with Zenit, that they've hired Spalletti last autumn. They've basically given him carte blanche to do whatever he likes. He's been able to bring in pretty much everybody that he was after. He spent over €20 million on Bruno Alves, the Portugal international defender. He then kind of spent the summer stealing lots of players from his rivals. So he bought Sergei Semak and Alexander Bukharov from Rubin, who at the time were in second place. So, you know, he's been able to sort of go out and pretty much sign whoever he wants to. And in that sense, I think that it's not such a bad fit with Inter, where, you know, he's been able to kind of be the man in charge, stamp his authority, go out and sign whoever he wants to. I think that in a way that's how Inter like to build things, under a very strong authoritarian manager like Mourinho was. Time will tell whether there's any credence to the rumours linking Spalletti with Inter, but I'd hasten to say that he's not learning Russian. He still conducts all of his press conferences and interviews in Italian, which isn't unheard of. He has to wait another 9 months to enter the Champions League, because with the Russian season finishing now rather than in May June time, he's going to have to wait and play out the rest of his current Europa League season, in which Zenit are actually doing very well, to be fair, before he gets his crack at the Champions League with Zenit. Now, can he wait that long, or will he fancy taking on Inter in the knockout rounds? That's a big question.
Just briefly talking, going fully onto the Russian league. Worthy winners, Zenit. What were their nearest challenges like?
Well, Zenit were by far and away the best team in Russia for the entire year. They were record breaking starters to the season. I think they managed 33 points in their first 13 games in the league, which is a Russian record. And it was only really in the last month that they had a bit of a wobble. They've only lost two games all season. Both of them came in the last 3 weeks against big rivals, Spartak and CSKA Moscow. Having said that, I think the issue is that Zenit have been provided with pretty much, you know, incalculable resources to do whatever they wanted to do this season. I've said on this pod before, Gazprom are Zenit's backers. They're the state gas and, well, basically any other kind of industry giant, one of the biggest companies in the world, and they've given a blank check to Spalletti to do what he wants to with the club. And none of the other clubs, despite oligarch ownership, have really, you know, have the resources to touch them. As far as on the field is concerned, I've already hinted that Zenit have bought Rubin's two of Rubin's best players in Bukharov and Semak. CSKA Moscow are probably the second best team in Russia, pound for pound. And they've just had problems using all of their wealth of talent. Keisuke Honda, who we talked about a lot in the summer, still at CSKA Moscow. It's finding it hard actually to even get into the starting 11 at the moment. I think that Leonid Slutsky, who is the coach at CSKA Moscow, is just finding it difficult to shuffle his pack into the right positions. So it's been an interesting season, but yeah, Zenit really were nailed on winners pretty much from week 5 or 6.
Shame about the fans, the celebrations afterwards though.
Yeah, that's right. I my quip, if I can call it that, of my own comment at the time, it was Zenit win the title and the fans celebrate the only way they know how. They were playing at home to Rostov, and on the final whistle, thousands and thousands of fans, young men it must be said, invaded the pitch, chased the players off into the changing room, and then proceeded to destroy a set of goalposts and kick lumps out of the pitch, and generally ran around the field for about an hour after the game, causing untold kind of damage to quite a lot of Zenit's stadium. And there was a few disturbances in St. Petersburg during the evening in which a policeman was injured. Zenit's own press office and the St. Petersburg city authority have put that down to a policeman falling over and hitting his head. And again, I do think that there's something more to that story.
Quite possibly. Who would have thought that reports in the Russian press might not be entirely... Anyway, we'll leave it there for this week before we get Vladimir Putin setting his hordes on us. But, Chris, before we round up for this week, a quick announcement.
I'll just get to it, shall I?
Yeah.
No podcasts in December.
Why?
We are going on hiatus because... we've lost use of the studio due to the fact that I will shortly be leaving the company that I work for, who have been very, very kind in letting us do 72 plus some European football specials in here. So it's all changed, but we will be back after the new year. It will be slightly different. We'll keep the format as close to what we do as we can. The sound might be slightly odd for a few weeks.
As we adjust to it, yes. And I'd like to add my thanks to Chris's employers for letting us use... the studio, it's been a pleasure. But we're not talking about the death of the podcast here. By no means at all. We've still got one more next week. And, of course, we know you'll be wanting to tune in because our main guest next week is Ollie Irish from Who Ate All the Pies. Excellent man and very entertaining indeed. And in the meantime, there's many other things you can do. And I'd just like to say, if you are going to miss us in December, have a listen to Chris's podcast. Sound of Football. If you want a good substitute for us, just please come back afterwards.
Really. Bless you. I'm getting all emotional now. Sorry.
Sorry. Well, we even had cake on in here, but we didn't even mention that. It was very kind of you to bring cake as well.
Anytime.
Yeah, we're not just kind of just we don't take bribes in cake necessarily.
Pies.
Still waiting for our first pie to be sent in. Remains for me to just give a few plugs and then thank the pod. Please do go to justgiving.com/twofootedtackle. We're raising money for CRY, Cardiac Risk in the Young. Very important charity, especially given the work that it does with young footballers, making sure that we don't see any more tragedies of young footballers dying very young indeed. Please do go there, justgiving.com/twofootedtackle. We know that if everybody who listened to this pod just donated £2, we could easily give them £1,000 more for Christmas, and we'd love to be able to do that. So please, justgiving.com/twofootedtackle. If you want to engage in mardy conversations with Chris over Twitter about football, twitter.com/twofootedtackle is the place to do to follow him. Also, the latest news and stuff from Two Footed Tackle he'll be pumping out on there, as well as facebook.com/twofootedtackle to become a fan of the pod, the website, the everything. www.twofootedtackle.com for all various views, news, and whatever else you want to put on there. It's always good, robust debate. And podcast at twofootedtackle.com if you wish to get in touch. If you've got any questions for next week's pod, do send them through, or you can just email how much you're going to miss us, or how much you're just very glad that you don't have to download us every Thursday. Either or, I don't mind. Anyway, thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. Thank you, Chris Oakley.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, James Appel.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Chris Nee.
Thank you.
And enjoy your footballing weekend, wherever you're off to. I might even be at Tooting this week. Who knows? Take care. Be back next week.
Twofootedtackle.com.
Got my headphones stuck. Nearly went down the back of my shirt.
That's a hidden Trexel, yeah.